Welcome to Measured Impact, where we share behind-the-scenes stories of the world's leading mission-driven companies. Because when it comes to activism, brand building, and revenue growth, we believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Let's dive in.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Today, I am joined by longtime Ben & Jerry's team member, digital lead, and my buddy, Jay Tandon. Jay leads all things digital for Ben & Jerry's, including marketing, decom, social, and web. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So I like to start off with an easy one. Who are you? Where do you live? And who do you work for?
Jay Tandon. Live in Vermont, home of Ben & Jerry's, also home of a record snowfall year, which is very lovely. Yeah, I work for Ben & Jerry's. We run the global digital team. Been doing that for a few years, but about 16 years at the company all in. So it's been a good ride.
So what led you to that, to the role you're at today? How did you get hooked up with Ben & Jerry's? How'd you start?
The history books go back to my college job. I started in college as a scooper at the flagship shop in Vermont and thought the company was cool and wanted to know more about what it was all about and started scooping. And the rest is kind of history, but pinged around within the company, mostly in marketing, mostly in digital, and have sort of netted to the role that I'm in now. But fun fact, my first full-time job was answering phones, just doing that game of not enough cookie dough in my pint, or, we don't like what you said about some activism topic. So I heard it all from people.
Well, then I have to ask before I get into the nerdy data questions, what is the hardest part about being an ice cream scooper at a Ben & Jerry's or any ice cream shop, I guess, generally?
It's all so good, honestly. People are so happy to be there. Everyone's smiling. It's usually, you're out with a group of friends or family, there are not that many bad things. Every once in a while, you get somebody upset about something that is not that important.
Your scooping arm gets substantially stronger than your offhand.
Yeah, exactly.
So talk to me about what Ben & Jerry's does and how you guys think about yourselves in the world.
Yeah, most people know that Ben & Jerry's is kind of more than just an ice cream company. The co-founders sort of were the originators of this idea of a three-part mission or a triple bottom line. They're cited in all the business textbooks and the MBA classes, the MBA classes that I didn't take, unfortunately. But this idea that it's about more than just turning a profit, more than just selling the ice cream. And so that has permeated for the over four decades that the company's been in business. And I think it's still truly embraced and championed by the people in the company. And so when it comes to how we think about our work, everybody owns a bit of the social mission. And I think particularly in the digital space and in my role with my team, we sort of control or kind of have the keys to a lot of the public facing channels that people see the brand in the world. And so it's a super important part of our work is to bring our advocacy work to life, bring our social mission to life, because it's core to who we are as Ben & Jerry's. And so we've had people in the company at times say, we're a social justice company that happens to make ice cream. And so I think that's a good summary of where Ben & Jerry's is at.
So when you started with the team, what was your expectation about how that would kind of manifest itself, what that would look like, and how is that kind of maybe misplaced in terms of I'm going to go work for these social justice warriors and change the world? How does that actually manifest itself or differently than you expected it would when you get onto the job?
Yeah, funnily enough, and I'll go back in my, the Rolodex of memories at Ben & Jerry's, but one was when I first moved from being outside of the shop into the corporate headquarters. The global headquarters are here in Vermont. And I kind of expected it can't be as good as it looks from the outside, right? People can't really believe this stuff as much as they do. And maybe it was being a, just out of college kid, like skeptical of for-profit companies. But I think I was like really pleasantly surprised the amount people care. People really give a shit about the mission and that's why they're there. And so I think to the question of sort of what was that experience like, I think that was my first standout memory. I think as it relates to more of my, contemporary experience, it's a similar theme and thread, which is the idea that the people in the company truly embody all three parts. I think you see a lot of for-profit entities where either their social mission or their corporate social responsibility is sort of separated from the rest of the day-to-day working teams or organization. And that couldn't be further from the truth at Ben & Jerry's, right? Everybody wants a piece of the social mission. In fact, It's the opposite, where you kind of have to say, hey, this stuff happens over here, this other work happens over there.
So in that vein, how do you guys think about success, right? Like when you're sitting down for your digital team meetings or you're hanging out with the, you know, executive team, what does success look like and how do you think about that at a high level?
For us, success is, did we win or lose? And when I say we, I mean, what are the issues and causes that we're looking to champion and support? And are we making progress on those things at the end of the day? And I think that is emblematic of the fact that this is, for us, our social mission is not just a thing that we do to make people like us. It's a thing that we do to drive progressive social change in the world. And so I guess when we sit down and when we think about measuring impact, we hold ourselves to a really high standard, not just because that's what we are setting out to do, but also because as a for-profit company, we want to hold ourselves to a really high standard of, are we really delivering or are we greenwashing or are we, right? Like, are we just going to appear to be doing this because it could benefit us? And I think that has been one of the things that's really kept us honest and made us so laser focused on measuring impact and ensuring that every dollar we put into issue advocacy is working as hard as possible.
When you talk about sort of greenwashing and the idea of how to sort of check your own intention and the things that you guys are doing, what mechanisms do you guys use to just sort of ensure you're prevented from your own virtue signaling? And how do you guys check each other on making sure that the things you put out are in line? Is there, you know, specific things that you try to do or try not to do that keep you on the right path there?
Yeah, the first sort of asterisk I'd put on all of this before digging into maybe some more of the sort of measurement side is we align everything that we're doing with movement leaders and partners who know more about a lot of the issues that we're working on than we do. And so we don't claim to be the experts, but we always want to be aligned with and supporting the experts and making sure that strategically what they want to do is what we go out and do. And so the reason that matters is because there can be a variety of different objectives when doing communications. Sometimes you have goals that are just purely based on, you know, taking the recent example of the endangerment finding, which was kind of rolled back by the EPA. The endangerment finding was a cornerstone regulation that allowed the EPA to regulate carbon emissions. We just needed people to know about that. And so a post where you just need to get the word out and create some buzz, I mean, that piece of content is going to look really different than something where, hey, maybe in a month's time, there will be a coordinated action where progressive climate groups say, we need to put pressure on X or Y, and now it's going to be focused on an action. And so the type of content we do to drive people down the kind of funnel to take an action, again, is going to look very different than just an awareness play. Or if we're trying to get somebody to really understand or be educated on the inner workings of the EPA and their policies, that would be a different piece of content and that would look different. So I think movement aligned and then based on what is our specific objective, what are we trying to get people to do? And then there are going to be different signals and, you know, data signals that we'll get back in that journey that, again, hold us accountable to driving the right types of impact, but also help us optimize and improve that over time.
So one of the things I didn't hear you reference was how that ties to posts about ice cream. And so how do you guys think about the two existing together? If you're choosing an objective for your values post, does that live in a different world from your ice cream forward content, your branded content? How do they play together?
I think it's a symbiotic relationship. And that's what makes the messages that we push as Ben and Jerry's so special, is that we can talk to people in a lot of different ways, but at the end of the day, marketing a product versus marketing an idea are essentially the same things. It's like, do we want you to just sort of know about it? Do we want you to immerse yourselves more deeply and be more deeply educated about it? Or do we want you to do a thing, like buy a thing or take an action? And so this sort of idea of like driving awareness, driving education, or driving conversion apply to both our product stuff as much as our value stuff. And interestingly, I think a lot of the rigor and acumen at the company, particularly on like performance marketing, actually started from our advocacy work, because we're not a D2C brand, right? We don't have online sales at any significant scale through owned properties. And so we actually like learn a lot from what we're testing and trying in the advocacy world and actually referring that back to how we do product marketing, which I think is a cool experience. So they're very much hand in hand. And I think we've even seen instances where, because we have the platform that we have as it relates to our advocacy and our values. We get a lot of traction on social for that, and we're doing it in meaningful ways that, again, are movement aligned and very thoughtful. But we've actually seen that it actually floats the product marketing sometimes too. So we can see instances where if a piece of product communications comes after maybe a high visibility advocacy moment where we're driving action on a policy or a piece of legislation, the posts that we do after that, even if they're ice cream, can sometimes actually do better, which is a very interesting revelation. And honestly, certainly helps us message up through the organization to say, look, not only is the work that we're doing on advocacy really moving the needle and measurable and helping find policy wins or what have you, it's good for business. And I think oftentimes people find themselves in a defensive position with this type of work in within the for-profit space where you're sort of just defending this stuff to exist at all. This idea of purpose or, you know, as we say, you know, progressive advocacy. Whereas for us, it's even the opposite. We're on the offensive. We're like, this is good for business and more people should be doing that. And so, yeah, the product stuff and the ice cream stuff mixed with the advocacy really works. And, you know, Ben's favorite phrase is he always says the spoonful of sugar. And so, you know, it's almost like the inverse now where it's like the advocacy helps the ice cream go down. I don't know.
Yeah. Sounds like you have a pretty sophisticated infrastructure and ecosystem of just like culture of measurement, right? I guess my question is kind of a little bit high level, which is I think a lot of brands struggle with measurement. And the assumption is often that the struggle on the measurement side is within the kind of the nuts and bolts, the data, the tracking, the blocking and tackling of actually doing it. But it sounds to me like you guys are saying that it's some of it's cultural, like building a culture of performance marketers, like you said. Help me understand for you guys, where does the challenge lie? Like what makes it hard, right? Obviously you guys are committed to measuring impact both on the value side and on selling ice cream. Is the data the hard part? Is the culture the hard part? Is the buy-in the hard part? Like where do you rank the challenges that go into something like that?
I think the culture piece is there, right? The anecdote I mentioned as it relates to people in the organization really believing in this stuff, that is there. That foundation is firm. People want to kind of do the right thing, so to speak. For us, it's at least historically was a bit of signal versus noise. And so what within the vast kind of array of data that exists in the digital space, how do you make sense of it? And so we've put a lot of time in, you know, in partnership with Loose Grip to finding the signal within the noise, because there are so many data points you could look at. There are the massive vanity metrics that you could look at, which really are oftentimes red herrings, and really focusing on moving the needle and driving the impact. And I'll give an example where there have been instances where we've sort of co-opted a trend on social, like TikTok trend, and sort of infused our brand voice into it, which means infusing ice cream and sometimes infusing messages around our values. Those perform really well. Those are oftentimes just that. They perform. They're almost performative. And so again, with us wanting to be really clear around what does perform well mean in what context, something just getting a lot of video views doesn't necessarily add up to progress on the issues that we want to see progress on. And so if we were just to look at video views, we'd say, oh, those kind of trendy videos, like those do great. And like, let's just do those.
Just do more memes. All memes all the time.
All memes all the time. And that's not our job. Our job is to move the needle on the social justice issues that we're working on in concert with our partners. And so that has been the challenge, but I think it's one that we've stepped into and made some sense of in a way that we've been able to refine the kind of model over time. And I think Ben and Jerry's across the globe last year drove over 200,000 policy actions through engaging our fans on these topics. And I think that's really awesome and quantifiable.
So I'm interested, you guys clearly look at all this stuff with a lot of intention and you're setting these objectives. What's the biggest challenge when you're trying to sort of bring the adoption of this kind of thing, right? How do you operationalize this? You guys obviously have different languages and different teams, and there's probably 100 agencies that you work with on different projects. When you guys get to the scale that you guys are at, how do you socialize or operationalize this, like, ethos of intention? It's an assumption that it seems so obvious, like, of course you would measure what works the best. And it actually doesn't always work like that. So how do you guys think about making that real?
That's a great question, because I've been fortunate that I think at least for the past many years, we've been in an environment internally and with a lot of our core agency partners where that's table stakes. But I think taking a, you know, a simple example of trying to explain to an activism manager, we have activism managers in six countries, our six biggest countries that we're in, trying to be like, here's why UTM tags are really important, right? And it's just like, it's this string of random characters and nobody knows what it means. That's tough, but I think you tell the story. If you show a side-by-side of, here's what we can see from insights on a post-performance without those things versus here's what we can see with those things, you go from, here's the one-line explainer of, it reached this many people, to, I can tell you a whole story, basically, about what happened all because of those pieces of data. So I think as much as data is perceived by some as boring, it's the fertile ground from which you can tell stories and kind of help people make sense of the world. And so I think that's the kind of path that we have taken. And I know that's something that Loose Grip embodies as well, that I think is really powerful.
Yeah, it seems like with you guys, there's some level of consistency too, right? Like it's like repetition of the message doesn't change that much over time. You know, you guys might jump onto different styles and formats and be changing things at the micro level. But my sense is, especially talking with folks on your team, is the core message of your purpose doesn't change that much. And how you're going to think about measuring that remains pretty consistent.
Yeah. I think it's funny. We'll like give an example of Cherry Garcia through the ages, right? I can show you a Facebook post from 2009 of Cherry Garcia, and then I can show you a TikTok we did last week, and then the eight iterations of social in between, right? Here's the tweet version, here's the Instagram version, here was the Snapchat version. And yeah, the message does remain the same, but the way it shows up is how we evolve ourselves while remaining true to the brand, right? It's still Cherry Garcia, or it's still fish food, right? That are these like cultural things that have relevance to people.
This is like the millennial / Gen Z version of like people being like, there was newspaper ads, and then there was radio, and then we had television, right? It's like that same thing, but it's like you have a core web-based infrastructure 15 years ago, and the social channels have changed, but the way you guys approach it seems to be pretty consistent.
Yeah. And I think over my 16 years at the company, not all of that time had been in marketing, but I think we've really had the opportunity to take an incredibly powerful brand and translate it for the digital era. Because, you know, even talking with the co-founders, they'll be like, we can't even believe the scale at which we're able to have impact for the social mission through digital. And that's been a really nice experience to have, but it has required, how do you stay true to who you are while social environments and social norms are changing all around you? And again, you have to kind of have marketeers who believe in brand stewardship and believe in what the brand's about, which we're fortunate to have a really powerful kind of external sort of embodiment of the brand. But then you need to look at the data of like what's working. So how do you like marry up the almost the art and the science, I guess.
So when you guys are measuring for the sake of driving change, right, a decision making action, give me a feel on like what's a thing that you measure that you feel like is really informative or directionally influential as you guys think about decisions that you're going to make about what your next content's going to look like or web project's going to be or platform you're going to try or a metric you're just like psyched to look at that when it comes up on that next report, like that you're like, oh, that one always makes me feel like I'm smarter or I know something more than I knew before.
Yeah. I mean, one that has a good wow factor that I think a lot of people in digital marketing understand is click-through rate for email versus all social, right? Everybody wants to ooh and ah over the millions of people reach, but it's like, well, if you were trying to get people to the site to do something, wow, email actually was 10 times better than everything else. And I think that's one that we try and keep an eye on to keep everybody in check because it's easy to be in the like social black hole. But like there are other ones that are more creative that we've used over time. Instead of just looking at time on site, look at engaged time on site, right? Are you actively scrolling? Are people actively scrolling through and consuming the content on site, meaning they're actually reading it? Or did they just leave a tab open and it sat there and that inflates your time on site number? And so I think you have to even kind of go deeper than maybe some of the out of the box metrics and look a little deeper around true engagement. And I think video views versus time spent viewing is a good example of that as well. So particularly with the native analytics and TikTok, it's like video views, sure, that's the number that as the publisher you can see right there on the thumbnail before you even click into your analytics, you can see that. But then when you actually jump in and get a little deeper and you start to look at retention, that can be the more telling stuff. And so I always get excited to look at those more so than what I see day to day, just flipping through the app. You got to peel a layer deeper. And I think when you do is that's how you find the real story.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we see a lot where it's like, it's really hard to not just get so excited about these giant TikTok numbers, especially all these algorithmic platforms. And then sometimes you'll go and you're like, average watch time was 1.25 seconds, which was just past our titles card, whatever the thing was that you're trying to get across. So it's hard, right? It's a hard thing to not look for the best information, best metric, and then turn that into the narrative of your story, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we'll take the big numbers home to the bank all the time too. Like, but that's not what we're going to optimize performance based on. We'll love to showcase total reach for the year or something and just get a big number and everybody can feel good about that. And, you know, pats on the back happen or whatever. But really, we all know as a culture within the team, that's not how we optimize. That's not how we get better. That's how we can say, you know, did pretty good overall, but we really want to dig deeper as it relates to how to innovate. And I think when a new platform presents itself in the way that TikTok did, but you know, the long line of things before that, Snapchat before that, Instagram before that, you really do have to innovate what you're doing, and what worked the prior year won't work the next year. And I think if you're just chasing the big numbers, you're going to miss the real meat of what's happening.
Yeah, it's hard to not look at that specific number set and go, oh man, that number's so big, I want to talk about that big number. But it's my sense is for you guys, when you're looking for ways to learn and make decisions, when you are so likely to have virality and algorithmic success like you guys are, it can be a little bit of a black box as to what success is if it's all just about the big number, right? Because like quadrillion views, because TikTok happened to like us on that one day or whatever, right? Like, and is American TikTok's algorithm different now or whatever? There's like a lot of unknowns, but it feels like you guys are able to try to steer away from that a little bit, at least to go, yeah, but what can we know from that data or better data that will help us inform how to do more of the stuff that works and less of the stuff that doesn't work?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. And I think we'll still look at the trend line on something. Like, I'd rather know, are the number of videos that we're doing that are getting X amount of whatever the target metric is, are those growing over time versus, hey, we had two videos that reached 15 million people, right? Like, one of those shows steady growth. The other is, yeah, we happen to hit the trending audio just right. And whatever, for some reason or another, this worked. And we basically, it's impossible to tell why. Because like those kinds of things, like, I don't know what to do with that as a communications person or a marketer or what have you. Whereas, hey, we're slowly testing and iterating and finding things that work and ticking up over time. That brings me more satisfaction. And I think that shows more sustainability over time for the brand and for the message. And at the end of the day, for the impact we're able to have through our advocacy work.
Yeah. So a while ago, you were talking about values post followed by maybe a totally unrelated post. Give me a little bit more detail about why you guys even thought to go down that route. Like you said, a lot of brands, especially who are activism or values or sustainability forward, they kind of treat everything in these silos. And it sounds like you guys are intentionally trying to like remove those silos all the time, including understanding how one impacts the other. What led you down the path to try to even figure that problem out? Because I feel like it's pretty unique in terms of an approach.
The highest level, we're Ben and Jerry's and we're multifaceted. And you can't pull apart the this versus that. It's just like, this is who Ben and Jerry's is. We're here to do both. And that's what makes it great to work for Ben and Jerry's. But as far as that idea of like, if you post one thing first around our values, and then you post something about a product after, and maybe there's a halo effect toward the product piece, just through dumb luck, honestly, like we didn't have that hunch necessarily. But I think people now know, people who are like working in the social spaces, it's like, if you have something perform really well, the next thing you post is probably going to do a little better. And so we've noticed that on balance, the stuff we post about our advocacy is more potent than our product stuff. That's not always the rule, but on balance over the course of a year, when you look at social performance. So it's only expected that, you know, when we post stuff after a high visibility moment that the algorithm's going to juice that a little bit. And so we've tested with different, both the approach of unintentionally posting a product thing after an advocacy thing, or if we, you know, had an advocacy thing that was, you know, got a lot of traction. All right, what's the next thing we want them to know about that issue? We'll post that organically next, even though it's not going to perfectly reach the same group of people. We know algorithmically that will have legs. And so it can also help us sort of double down on our, you know, our advocacy initiatives as well.
So I guess my question that follows into that is, if your values content, if your activism content, if it generally performs better than your flavors content, or better, you know, in whatever you just decide to determine the success is going to be. How do you guys think about maintaining a balance? I think there's a tendency for brands, when they see success, it's really hard to guard against just like, okay, well, let's just do that every time, all the time, just like that, because that thing worked better. Let's do more of that, more of that, more of that. And in a lot of ways, it sounds like you guys have the opposite problem that most might expect, which is like, you have a big appetite for values content, for activism content, for social content. But how do you make sure there's still the right mix of like, some people just want to know about the ice cream, right? And some people just want to like be fans of good ice cream. And how do you make sure you can still speak to them and keep a cadence that feels balanced in some way?
Yeah, we have essentially a loose split between our sort of like product-y, fun, you know, general Ben and Jerry's versus our advocacy stuff. And so we try and hit that sort of percentage split. It's something like 1/3 of what we do is our advocacy, and the other 2/3 is not the advocacy stuff. But I think from a capacity, it's a lot more work to do the advocacy side of things. And so we're certainly putting in a lot of effort there. Ben & Jerry's has been owned by a parent company since 2001. And so there have been times where throughout the history of the company, there's been pressure to like, oh, people really like that. Ramp it up. Do more of that. Because they're like, it's good for business. And I think what we always have to keep people in check is we don't do it because of that. Like, sure, there may be some benefits that the business gets, but we do it because we want to be strategically aligned with what people in these different social justice movements are doing and what they want us to do, what's helpful. And you can't manufacture that. You can't manufacture that authenticity. You can't manufacture it being really credible work. And so, yeah, there would be, depending on your seat in the organization, there may be a perspective of, you know, how do you really ramp that up and have that be 70% of what we're doing if that's doing so well or whatever? And we always have to be like, no, the reason it's so potent is because it's really thoughtful, and we're blessed. We have activism managers who all of them come out of the nonprofit world, and they have partnerships with different NGOs and movement groups, and it's all really informed by what's needed to advance these issues, not, hey, that worked on social, let's do more of it. And so I think that's a constant battle as somebody who's both, for myself, like heavily engaged and passionate about the advocacy side, but also part of the marketing organization, because those can be, you know, competing at times.
I guess one of the questions I have is, when you have these disparate stakeholders, right? Activism managers who have previously worked at NGOs, right? It's pretty obvious what they're going to be passionate about. And on the other side, you have folks who are maybe brand marketers or flavor advocates, flavor gurus, whatever you guys want to call them, right? You have people who are really excited about the product and the quality of the product and the new releases. How do you make sure those groups can learn from each other in terms of performance and building alignment between teams who maybe have pretty disparate passions and objectives and goals for what their role is?
I think one thing we've always been certain to do is, to the best of our ability, we don't separate out the content development process for ice cream stuff over here with this set of people and advocacy stuff over here with that set of people. It's one process. The way we measure it is the same. The cadence on which we report out on it is the same. And so everybody's along for the same ride. And I think that is really important, because sometimes there can be the perception that there would be tension between, you know, marketers and the advocacy team. But I think the beauty of Ben & Jerry's, and coming back to the culture of Ben & Jerry's, is everybody is super invested. And so I think that is super important to say, this is one process, one Ben & Jerry's process. And sometimes it may lean heavily this way, the pendulum may swing that way, but we're all collectively pushing the Ben & Jerry's experience, not a product experience or a advocacy experience. And I think, you know, there's also very interesting learnings. And I started to allude to this with the performance marketing stuff earlier. Like, there are learnings that come out of the rigor that we apply to the advocacy side, where it is more end-to-end measurable, all like in digital environments, that the product side we just don't have, right? A lot of Ben & Jerry's is still sold in a grocery store, and it's not online, and we can't track that. We did a lot of work in St. Louis, where there was this jail. The jail mostly held people pre-trial. So they hadn't been convicted of anything. They just couldn't post bail. So they're essentially like in jail because they like didn't have money to pay bail. So 90% of the people there, it was disproportionately people of color. And so we partnered with a group called Arch City Defenders, and we were campaigning there. And we were campaigning on essentially pressuring the Board of Aldermen there in St. Louis to think differently about their budgets, right? They spend a lot of money on this jail, not so much on other services. We ended up doing a lot of work around performance marketing, around creative variations, copy optimization, audience optimization, that frankly was the degree of rigor that could then be taken to the product side. I'm sure there are tons of examples that go vice versa, where we have learnings on the product side that actually help the advocacy side too. And so I think the narrative to the collective Ben and Jerry's group is these things are actually stronger together, and they can inform each other in really different ways. And I think people have kind of signed up for that, and they see that value too, which is awesome.
Yeah, seemingly pretty symbiotic in the way that you guys think about it. Okay, I'm going to hit you with some quick fires. Number one, what is one thing you wish you could measure that is likely not measurable?
See, this is why I'm a digital guy. I'm like, everything's pretty measurable. This is like super granular, but you know, you're asking. Carousel swipes. I wish there was more information about carousel swipes because it's really hard to know. It's a great content type. But I think that we've often had questions of like, how long, how do you know what's working the best? Do people trudge through and they're reading stuff because they kind of feel like they just want to get to the end, or should it be shorter? So that's like a super granular one, but would be like really valuable, right? Instead of us poring over, you know, 8 tiles of carousels and all the copy and all those sites that we need to source when we have statistics in there and all that stuff, like a lot of work goes into that. And if that can be, you know, 3 swipes, not 8, that would be useful. And something we've sort of like grappled with over time, because sometimes in the advocacy world, you want to be a little verbose to a detriment. I think.
What you guys really want to find out is people want 30 slide carousels and they would like to hear all the things you have to say. Hear that, Instagram, give us some metrics, man. What brand or movement do you look up to kind of in this ethos of the space, that how you think about Ben and Jerry's, or organizations that you're excited about? Who do you guys kind of look up to when you're thinking about this blend of activism and purpose and profit?
There aren't a ton of brands that really fully embrace issue advocacy in the same way. But I think the two that stand out to me are Patagonia. I think they
never heard of full, them.
Yeah. Who are they? Fully live their values, very thoughtful, and you know, do some degree of advocacy. And the other would be Lush Cosmetics, also very progressive, have a lot of great advocacy campaigns in the kind of true sense of the word. But to be honest, I actually, if I'm thinking about what inspires me, like those are companies that kind of are at this intersection of like, you know, a triple bottom line or whatever you want to call it. It's some of these local organizers, like the St. Louis example that I gave, like this woman Inez, who was incarcerated in that jail and then like came out the other side and was like, I'm going to just go out and get after it and like get this done. And like that jail has been closed and demolished. And those people who just have the grit, like we talk about grit a lot, of just like, you just got to crank through, or like, when stuff happens in the world around us, we have all these marketing plans and annual plans and all this stuff. And sometimes you just need to like, put the pen to paper. What do we need to do? What do we need to say? And how to just get after it? And I think local organizers and local groups are strapped for resources often, and really have to just have the like gritty attitude, and they do. And I think I've talked with other people within Ben and Jerry's of like, when you get somebody who kind of has the grit, it's like, yeah, all right. You know,
that leads into my next question, which is, you know, these jobs are hard, right? Your job is hard. My job is hard. Everybody's job's hard, right? And so the question I like to hear on, how do you approach, like, you're on month 3 without a real break, and there's been lots of issues that are seemingly incredibly pressing at any given time, and launches and all the things, like, how do you go about just filling your tank up to like keep that grit front and center? What works for you in terms of building that as a resource?
This is a personal answer. No, I do. I literally do the polar opposite thing of my day-to-day job. If my day-to-day job is what it is, which is like professional emailer, sitting at a computer all day, I'm a rock climber. So I like go out into the woods by myself. I'm like sitting there with a rock and like some chalk on my hands, and I'm just like pulling really hard on these rocks, and like for no purpose other than to get to the top, which gets me nothing in life really. But it's just the polar opposite of the spectrum. It's very tranquil and very physical. And I don't know, that kind of helps me balance out living in the digital world and the data and all that stuff. And so it's like the nice balancing effect, I guess.
Yeah. The literal opposite of sending an email in some way, which is awesome. I'd remiss if I didn't ask, do you think a year from now or 2 years from now, we'll be talking more about AI or less about AI when it comes to the space?
More, for sure. I can expound on that, but this is rapid fire, so I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll save that for the AI podcast. Final question, but maybe the most important. If I was coming to Vermont, where would you send me or the listeners to get a really good sandwich?
Sandwich. It'd be really important. Well, actually, I have a place that works for breakfast or lunch.
Oh, that's even better.
Henry Street Deli in Burlington.
I've been.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
I mean, the breakfast sandwiches are amazing.
I've only had the breakfast sandwich, so I can't...
I think that's the superior option there, honestly. But also, like, massive sandwich, pretty cheap if you want, like, a, you know, more like a lunchy sandwich. You know, just a little corner store. It's, like, in the heart of, like, college downtown, so it's, like, got that kind of vibe to it, a little rough around the edges, but incredible sandwiches. For sure.
And what's your go-to order if you're getting a lunch sandwich?
Oh, a lunch sandwich? Breakfast sandwich is definitely like bacon, egg, and cheese kind of thing. But I don't know. I'm like a classic, just like turkey provolone or turkey cheddar, you know, something like simple like that. I like a basic sandwich. No oil. I nothing against the Italian, you know, sandwich fans out there. But like the oil thing, it's just never done it for me.
It does it for me, but I respect your right to your own opinion, even if it's wrong.
Well, I don't know. I don't know Henry Street's... Italian is, but I'm sure it's good.
Awesome. Well, Jay, this has been super helpful. I'm so excited to hear about everything you guys have going on, and it sounds like you guys are really living it out, which is awesome. And it's exciting to sit on the outside and sort of see you guys really invest into both from the flavors performance and the values performance. It's pretty clear you guys live and breathe it, which is not always the case. So thank you so much for joining us and giving us a little bit of time.
Thanks for having me.
We will throw a couple links in the show notes to the organizations that Jay mentioned. And if you want to follow Jay, where would they find you?
Man, LinkedIn, I guess.
On a rock well, in the woods.
Yeah. No, here's my theory. Here's my theory. As somebody who's in social for a living, I actually try and spend less time on my own social because it clouds my understanding of the reality. And so I actually try and stick to looking at, you know, the numbers for our own world and less my own. You don't want to be the N of one guy, you know?
It's true. Yeah, I saw this thing and it did really good on my personal page, so we should apply that to the brand. You can find more about Ben & Jerry's on their social channels. Jay and I both would love you to subscribe to their email because that's where you get the good stuff and that's what performs best. And we'll drop some links in the notes. Thanks again, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you. See ya.